WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the O.J. Simpson civil trial, Judge Fujisaki placed a gag order on the Goldman family, forbidding them to publicly discuss the issues of the case. Now that the trial is over, the members of the Goldman family offer their perspective on the civil and criminal trials in their new book, His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. They also share some of their memories of Ron in the hopes that he will gain a public identity as a person, not just a victim. My guests are Ron Goldman's father, Fred Goldman, and Ron's younger sister, Kim Goldman. Kim and Ron were very close when they were growing up. Their birth mother, Sharon Ruffo, left the family when they were children and stayed pretty much out of their lives. Ruffo was a plaintiff in the civil trial. Yesterday, she agreed to settle for $1.3 of the $7.2 million in compensatory damages awarded by the jury in the civil case. I asked the Goldmans to compare how they felt after the criminal and civil trials.
After the criminal verdict, I was devastated and shocked beyond belief and outraged, and I felt cheated and disappointed, confused, scared, because the killer was going to be walking the streets. And then for the civil case verdict, I was pleased. I was proud of the efforts on behalf of our lawyers and the commitment that our family made, and that we stuck to that. It's all the same types of feelings, but, you know, it went the way that we had hoped it did this time. But the reality is still that he's out there. So,
Fred Goldman, what about you?
Well, I think for the criminal trial, I was devastated. I was absolutely numb for hours. It was too much for me to swallow. I was one in the family that, by the time we heard that there was a verdict, had pretty much decided in my own mind that the jury was going to find him guilty. I'd never thought beyond anything more than a hung jury, at the worst. But when that verdict came in, I was stunned, overwhelmed, shocked, crushed, hurt. I felt betrayed by the whole system, and certainly felt betrayed by the court. When it came to the civil trial, as Kim said, it was in good part effort that our attorneys had put forth, and we felt confident in what they were doing. But we had the experience of the criminal trial to deal with, and couldn't even go into the civil trial awaiting the verdict with some assurance that the right thing would occur. But when it did, I was relieved and elated. I was exactly the opposite that we had been, or I had been, during the criminal trial.
What was the difference in your roles in each trial?
Well, I think certainly we had a role. In the civil trial, it was our case against the defendant. In the criminal, it's the state against the defendant. And we were babes in the woods, so to speak, during the criminal trial. There aren't a lot of rights available to the victim's families in a criminal trial, something that's very sad to me. But certainly we had the input, the opportunity to discuss the things that we were going to do or not going to do during the civil trial, and at least we felt some involvement and some satisfaction.
What is the biggest thing you wanted to see done differently in the civil trial than was done in the criminal trial?
Well, I think that we were hoping, and our attorneys agreed, that they were going to put on a much more condensed case, much cleaner, everything to the point, not spend weeks and weeks on DNA and get confusing with heavy technicalities. So that there was a lot of things, I think, that were done differently. That was primarily one.
How much money are you actually expecting to see? I know money isn't the issue to you, but
we've never ever discussed it.
No, I don't. In fact, when we heard the uh, The compensatory damages.
I didn't even hear it until it was reported on the news.
Then the punitive damages. We never had one bit of discussion mm-hmm. about the dollar amount.
Never.
The only thing that struck me about those two awards, I guess, judgments, was that I looked at it as the jury sending a message of how much punishment they wanted to meter out.
Fred Goldman, when did you decide to issue the challenge to O.J. Simpson that if he signs a confession, he wouldn't have to pay any of the damages?
It was during a radio interview roughly a week ago, and it was somewhat off the top of my head. I had heard a radio talk show host in L.A., a favorite of mine, a man by the name of Larry Elder, and he had made a comment about something pretty much almost exactly to that effect the day before as I was listening to his program. And it struck me as kind of an interesting idea when I heard him mention it. And then a day or so later, I'm posed with the question about the issue of the monetary awards. And my response was as it was, that it meant nothing to me, and that if he wanted to sign a confession and have it broadcast all over the nation and all over the world, I'd be glad to ignore the judgment.
What would that do for you, the public confession?
Well, I think it would be further acknowledgement, public acknowledgement of his guilt.
We've only wanted him to take responsibility and the responsibility be placed on him for being a murderer. And if he signed a confession and it was published and it was under penalty of perjury and all of the other, you know, legal mumbo-jumbo, so to speak, then we would have proved our point beyond what the jury already found. He would have finally had to agree to it. And if anyone, you know, pays attention to what we say as a family and what we stand for, then it shouldn't have been a shock that my dad made that comment, because that's what we've always maintained.
Did O.J. Simpson ever say anything to either of you during the trial, express his sympathy about Ron?
No, he always would cast his eyes down on me. He would look me up and down as if I was prey for him. He would bat his eyelashes at me, pout his lips as in an appearance of a poor baby look. He was pointing at me, mocking me, laughing at me.
He'd point at you mockingly?
He would point at me, and there was one occasion there was a reporter standing in between us, and I was staring at him, and he turned the reporter around, and he pointed at me, and he says, "See what I deal with on a 24-hour day basis? Look what she does to me. Look at her staring at me." I mean, he said it loud enough so that I could hear it. He sent someone over to me in the hallway one day, some woman that he claims is a friend of his. I don't know who she is. And she came up, and she tried to block my view of him, and I was, you know, persistent to just continue looking. And I told her that she was ineffective for what she was trying to do, and then she leaned over in my ear and she whispered, "He's pretty good looking to stare at, isn't he?" And I looked at her and I was appalled, and then the killer started laughing and his bodyguard started laughing, and they all thought that was pretty funny. And unfortunately, the media sees that and never reported it. They only report me glaring at him. They don't report the disgusting looks that he gives back to me.
Yeah, I want to say here that you refer to O.J. Simpson only as the killer in your book. You never mention him by name. That must be a conscious decision that you made.
No, yes, it is.
You know, actually, I don't think it was a conscious decision. It just became what he was, because we never called him by his name to begin with. It was always him or you-know-who, and then it became the defendant. And then when we all, you know, individually thought that he was guilty, that's just what it became. We didn't sit down and say, okay, we're going to start calling him the killer.
Right.
That's just what it was. And calling him anything else gives him a personality, which I don't think he deserves. And people that are around us, our lawyers, everybody calls him the killer. I correct people that are around me when they use his name, because it's uncomfortable for me. When waiters come up and they want to offer us that kind of juice, you know, we even correct the waiter sometimes, because I cannot stand to hear his name. And it's actually, even when reporters use him just by first name, that's actually even more offensive to me, when they don't even use his full name. They just call him by his first name as if he's their buddy. It's really troublesome to me.
Your lead lawyer during the civil trial, Daniel Petrocelli, said that if O.J. Simpson, he said this in court, if O.J. Simpson were innocent, would he let his lawyer mock Ron Goldman? "This young man tried to save the life of the mother of his children. He is a hero to O.J. Simpson."
Right.
Is this something you had talked about before?
No. Dan did that totally on his own.
And it's amazing because when I heard that, I thought, oh my God, that's it. I never even thought of that. The only image that I have of the killer and my brother is of rage and violence and murder. I would never have attached. It was very strange for me to hear that, because hearing that sort of made the killer have this warmth about my brother, and I just never ever experienced that feeling. So when Dan said it, I thought, oh my God, that's exactly right. It's exactly right. It just blew me away when he said that.
Do you wish the civil trial had been televised, or do you think it was better off without the televisions?
I personally wish it had been televised.
Me too.
I think that there were benefits and drawbacks to the cameras in the criminal trial. The benefit was that a nation had a chance to see a criminal trial in all its absurdities at work, and I think it terrified and scared a lot of people in this country. The positive, or the negative, was that it wasn't controlled, and it became the background for theatrics beyond belief.
But it also gave, way to the 13th juror, and the country as a whole viewed the evidence for themselves. And yes, you're supposed to accept the verdict, but in this case, the country was able to watch the case and judge for themselves. And for the majority of the country, they all thought he was guilty. Now, in the civil case, it was the defense who did not want the cameras in the courtroom. They didn't want it. They vehemently opposed it. And that was, we lost that. But I think we're all in favor of it. I think that the country deserved to see that the law can work sometimes.
Can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, please.
I think that it's a shame that the nation didn't have a chance to hear the testimony of the defendant. They would have heard, as we did, one lie after another, after another, after another. And perhaps if people had heard themselves, they would have been more willing to, in many cases, believe that the verdict in the criminal trial was, in fact, unjust.
But not only that, his demeanor on the stand. I mean, the perception was just because he didn't blow up or break down on the stands mean he did incredible. Well, when you watched him on the stand, he was fidgeting around. He was staring at the walls. He was, visibly uncomfortable. And that's something that lacks when you try to repeat, the information to the public, so...
In the book, you say that you liked the way Judge Fujisaki handled the courtroom. He was a no-nonsense judge. But he also put a gag order on the family. You weren't allowed during the trial to address the issues of the case in public. How did you feel about that gag order?
Well, I personally found it difficult. But I understood the judge's reasons for doing it. He didn't want to have anything remotely similar to what had occurred during the criminal trial. So I respected certainly his reasons for wanting the gag order. It was difficult to maintain a silence. But when all was said and done and we received the verdict that we had hoped for, I can say that the difficulty was well worth the wait.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that... at the time when it first happened, it was very frustrating, and to be under someone else's control, to be told what you can and cannot say, and always be wondering if what you said was pushing the envelope. But looking back at it now, I'm extremely grateful that we had a gag order, because had we been competing with the other side to constantly be putting a spin on things and everyone's opinion and trying to justify what... I mean, it just would have been nuts. I mean, in the prosecutors in the criminal case, they never really spoke out that much, and we constantly were listening to the defense attorneys and their yammerings. So I was grateful that we didn't have to do that this time.
My guests are Kim and Fred Goldman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Ron and Kim Goldman. The Goldman family has a new book called His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. I think one of the really incredible parts of your book is the very beginning, where you transcribe the phone answering machine tape from his house. And first there's a lot of friends just checking in, wanting to see what he's doing tonight and where was he yesterday. And then the friends start calling back saying, hey, I heard your name on the news. Could it be this is you? I hope it's not you. Maybe you'll never even respond to this message. It's just a chilling transcription.
It was.
You must have just...
Well, we have not heard the actual tape.
You didn't?
We only have the transcripts. And
was the tape used as evidence or something?
No. A reporter from the criminal case came across it. I have no idea. She won't tell me. But she wrote a beautiful story about it, and she gave me the transcripts way back when in the criminal case, and I've always held on to them. And when we were talking with the authors for the book, it came up, and I had them, and we gave them to them. And I'll tell you that I've read them a minimum 10, 15 times, and each time it destroys me. It just brings me to the absolute breaking point. You also, because you can also hear the frustration and the anxiety in those messages just by reading them. You can hear how scared his friends must have been, and
Fred Goldman, I know that at least one person has offered you an untraceable gun so that you could shoot O.J. Simpson. Did you have direct contact with this person?
Yeah, that was a terrifying experience. I was on a business call easily a year ago, maybe a little longer ago, and I was leaving an office complex, and someone called out my name and came up to me and offered their condolence, etc., and then proceeded to tell me that if I wished, they could get me a high-powered rifle with a scope that I could kill you-know-who with, and I was just shocked, and I said, no, thank you, and I started to walk away. And this person kept walking with me and said, well, you know, if you don't want to do it yourself, we can find somebody to do it for you. And I said, you know what, I don't have anything to do with this conversation. And I left. It was a scary experience, one that those kind of folks are walking around out there, and two, that they would even dream that I would have any interest in that. That's not how any of us in our family conduct our lives. And it wouldn't be something that I'd ever have any interest in doing. It's easy to be angry and vengeful. It's another thing to act it out.
Exactly. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've both had revenge fantasies that you wouldn't dream of acting out. But I think it's normal to have the revenge fantasies and then healthy to keep those fantasies
in check.
That's
exactly right. Most of us make those conscious decisions not to act out our frustration or our anger in a violent way. We make those decisions every day, and it makes us different from those violent individuals in our society, those criminals, et cetera, who choose just the opposite reaction. We're not about to sacrifice any of us to violence and lower ourselves to that level.
There's been so many changes in both your lives since Ron's murder. Fred Goldman, you had been a salesman in corrugated cardboard, and during much of the criminal trial, you had to still keep going to work. As you say in your book, you had a mortgage to pay, and
right.
So you couldn't afford to just leave your job. But now, now you have a different position. You're a national spokesman for a group called Safe Streets, whose goal is to reform the criminal justice system and cut down on crime. Did your job become more kind of meaningless to you as, like, after your son was killed?
The answer is yes. The passion that I had for my job of nearly 30 years began to dwindle as I realized there were other issues, other things that were taking precedence. And the more time that went by, the more angry and frustrated I became with a system that didn't seem to be to care much for decent, honest folks, didn't seem to care much for victims or their families, a system broken. And fortunately, I was given the opportunity to join Safe Streets, an organization that has very similar beliefs to mine, and that if we can affect some change in the criminal justice system to make it more, if I can use a bit of a corny term, user-friendly, to make it more understanding of the people that it's there to protect. And if it's not doing those things properly, if it's not protecting the public, then it's not doing its job.
I wonder if either of you would have, I know you both wanted to see a conviction for O.J. Simpson during the criminal trial. Would you have wanted him to get the death penalty?
Only if it would have been administered, like, right away. I don't believe, I have a hard time with the death penalty only because, how you know, people sit on death row for 30, 40 years and they don't ever go to the death to the death chamber. And I think that if you're going to put someone on death row, then you give them a certain number of appeals. You have a certain X amount of years to, you know, try to overturn your judgment against you, and then that's it.
Kim, did your brother's murder change your opinions about the death penalty?
Yes. I like to think of myself as a liberal thinker, and I was a psych major, so I was of the thinking that, you know, everyone deserves a second chance. You can rehabilitate. There's got to be some reason. You know, I was always trying to figure out the other side. And when this happened, I'll tell you, in about a split second, I threw all that out the window, and I said, I don't care what the other side was. I don't care why this person did this to my brother. He deserves the same pain and anguish that he inflicted on my brother, and I wanted to be there to watch. And I've never experienced that type of feeling, and I feel very strongly about that. I mean, an eye for an eye, and I never, ever felt that way before. And a lot of people criticize that, and my only answer is you just don't know until you're in that position.
Kim and Fred Goldman. The Goldman family has a new book called His Name is Ron, Our Search for Justice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.